Hello, welcome to the Save the Earth podcast. My name is Kent Hurtado, and I'm new to the podcast and I'm excited to be here for future shows. We have a fun episode for you guys as me and Ben Albi host two fellow podcasters, Mark and Alex from We Read Theory, a podcast you guys can find on Spotify, Apple Music, and YouTube. Thank you for tuning in to the Save the Earth podcast. Remember, you can also find us on Spotify, Apple Music, or WHUS.org. You can also find us on Twitter at UConn_Perg. That's P-I-R-G. The views, ideas, and opinions presented in this podcast do not represent WHUS, UConn Perg, or UConn as a whole. Hope you enjoy the show.
So before we start, tell me, if you could launch any billionaire into space, who would it be?
This is probably going to be like the most common answer you'd get, but I feel like it's got to be Elon Musk for the poetic justice. And because like, at least like with Jeff Bezos, like the people who love Jeff Bezos can actually afford the things that he sells. Mm. So you kind of like can make a little bit of sense of it. Whereas like, I feel like 90% of the people who like lionize Elon Musk will never be able to afford a Tesla anyway.
I feel like my answer, I won't say Elon Musk because that's already been taken, but probably Mark Cuban for similar reasons. Cause I feel like people almost forget he's a billionaire because he's a cool guy. He's the owner of the Mavericks. He's on Shark Tank. He's someone who's like relatable. And I feel like billionaires shouldn't be relatable. And he gives a incorrect picture of what they actually are.
That's a really
so Mark good Cuban.
Wow, was not expecting that. As a basketball fan, I feel like he's definitely like idolized in that community. Like people see him as a complete outsider and like, you know, the fans think he's one of them, definitely.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh. I would just go with Jeff Bezos because I mean, it doesn't really matter, but like it's kind of scary how much wealth and how much power that man holds. And just like, I think Elon Musk does have more money, but like the power that the organization of Amazon holds is pretty scary.
Have you guys seen these union busting ads that they're running on like various Amazon platforms like Twitch down in Alabama?
No. Yeah, I just saw a video on that.
Why is everything like everything bad revolving around Twitch now? One, like the anti-union ads, and two, why does the U.S. Army have an esports team that streams on Twitch? Why do we need that?
I did not know that.
Yeah, I've actually had it recommended to me a couple times. Every now and then, I think it's actually banned off Twitch more recently. But every time I'll like tune in casually just to see what's going on, it'll be like someone playing Counter-Strike with no commentary, and then every single comment in the chat is just various jokes about committing war crimes and invading countries for oil. And I think that they just took down the whole channel because that was all the engagement they were getting.
Or is coordinated raids from Hassan's channel.
It's kind of weird to see after like Facebook and YouTube especially went from like far right kind of hell holes for a really long time at least, that Twitch kind of seems to be moving in the opposite direction. Like all the most popular commentators on the site are very left-leaning really. And even like the non-political parts of the site get really heavily influenced by that because there's so much cross-pollination. And so that's kind of cool to see. So maybe that has something to do with it too.
I think the billionaire that I'd send up into space, if I had the option to choose, would be probably both Koch brothers.
Okay. Like, one living the person, dead body one dead of the one Koch brother?
Yeah, the dead body. Send them back up. We don't need them polluting the Earth even more.
There's actually a third stealth Koch brother as well. His name I constantly forget. But he's in there too. I don't think he's like, he's more of like a Mark Cuban type billionaire character where like, he's not comically evil for a billionaire. And so people just kind of forget and shunt him off to the side.
feel like that's like learning Will Smith actually has another kid besides Jaden and Willow Smith, who's just a normal person that you have never heard of.
I didn't know that.
That's amazing. Fun facts.
Or like the Jonas Brothers.
That's the other one I was going to say.
Yeah, they have a fourth one as well.
Apparently the youngest one is a complete dick. At least that's what the rumors are.
Really?
Yeah, just does not take fame well. Not to start any discourse.
So do you guys want to tell us about your podcast and what you guys do and like where people can find you?
Yeah, absolutely. Do you want me to take this one?
Yeah, sure. I'll fill in any gaps if I feel there are any.
Yeah, so we started We Read Theory kind of as the name itself is a bit of a response to a meme that we used to see all the time on left-leaning portions of the internet, where it felt like if someone didn't understand something, the response was always, you know, just read theory. Why don't you read theory? And then you might understand these things. And it was like, and I was at a point in my life where I hadn't read a whole lot of what would be considered theory, which is kind of a nebulous term anyway. And so I was interested in personally learning more about these kinds of like works. And I thought that it would be fun to see what I could do to make them more accessible. And kind of, instead of saying, go read theory, it's like, no, here in this place, we can all read theory together. And we can hopefully unlock some of that knowledge and make it more accessible to people who feel alienated by like getting homework from random people on the internet. And so instead it's like more of a study group instead of like a teacher giving you assignments. And I think that makes the whole thing a little bit more fun.
Not me, us, right?
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Well, I feel like you guys definitely accomplished that, because that's how I found you guys, was just searching up on Spotify, looking for explanations on, I think it was dialectical material, and you guys showed up, and like, that's how I got into it.
Yeah, that's definitely a style of episode that I want to do a little bit more of, because we usually focus on a book or an author, and I feel like concepts are probably more useful to a lot of people. And so that's definitely something I want to focus on. That's one of our episodes that I had probably the most fun researching and writing as well, because it was like a little bit of a puzzle, because nobody actually knows what dialectical materialism is.
So today, one of the specific things we wanted to talk about was how capitalism played an influence in the Texas cold freeze and their energy failures. And so we just kind of, first of all, Ben would give a little bit explanation of the climate aspect of it and how it came about and what led to it. But then we just want to hear what you guys think about how our government responded to it and like what are ways that like capitalism just overall influenced the entire situation.
Cool.
Right. Well, I guess I'll start with the environmental side, because I mean you could talk about how you definitely make the argument that capitalism caused the environmental problems that Texas is experiencing, but I think we're talking here more about like the response. But I'm going to read a quote from CBS News. I mean, not the best source I know, but it explains basically what happened on the climatic side from it. So it's the wavy jet stream theory, as it relates to climate change, was pioneered by Dr. Jennifer Francis at Woodwell Climate Research Center. The theory makes logical sense. Arctic warming reduces the gradient between warm and cold air, and thus weakens the temperature contrast mechanism, which powers the strength of the jet stream. That results in a weaker, more wavy jet stream, which is more likely to spill its cold air southward. So basically, it's just a bunch of climate irregularities because of the damage that we've done to the atmosphere and the environment in general that's causing basically cold air to spill south, and there's warm air kind of spilling north at the same time. So obviously there was that cold freeze in Texas. You know, low income and minority areas got hit the worst in terms of just energy failure and like lack of access to energy. So I kind of turned it from just being cold to the whole crisis. My question for you guys is like, what about capitalism turned this environmental issue into like a real problem?
I think that when you are criticizing like how capitalism responds to a crisis or how a capitalist system responds to a crisis, the number one word that you hear thrown around a lot is contradiction. And what a contradiction is basically just, at least in this context, the big contradiction is that is between the actual material purpose of the energy grid in Texas as it's designed, which is to make a lot of as much profit as possible for ERCOT and for the various middlemen, like most famously Gritty, which people buy their electricity through, and the what is supposed to be the social purpose of the electrical grid, which is to get people energy that they can afford and actually use, that they can use to do the various things they need to do in their lives. And so most of the time, there's some degree of alignment between those two goals. Like, people need electricity, so they buy electricity, they get it, and the company makes some profit. And I would argue that you could better, you know, kind of taking the profit out of the equation, then people get cheaper electricity. And I don't really care much about whether or not the company is profitable. But when the crisis hits, then the contradictions get really, really heightened, because then you have a situation where you have way less electricity than you have people that need it. And so the company and you have people who need electricity so much more than they might on an average day, where they're not at risk of freezing to death, or where their pipes aren't at risk of bursting if the heating in their house turns off. And so the problem with a for-profit company being in charge of that situation is that there's a contradiction, right, between the profit motive and what the actual people who it serves needs. And so you end up with that situation like with Gritty, where you have people paying, waking up in the morning with a $16,000, you know, electrical bill, or going backwards in the preparation leading up to this whole situation, is that it was known that something like this was possible, and it was known what kinds of winterizing could be done to various parts of the electrical grid. And that was also, once again, in contradiction to the actual goal of a company like ERCOT, which is just looking for a profit as possible. And they go, oh, well, if it happens once every 10 years, then it's not necessarily worth building and maintaining all this winterizing stuff, or at least it's not going to pay off in the short term. So it doesn't seem worth it to us. And so that's really that kind of conflict of interest between a private company's profit motive and the actual social purpose of having an electrical company or having an institution that is supposed to supply electricity, I think that's really at the core of what caused that whole breakdown.
I was just going to say, it relates to something that you guys talked about in your episode on Murray Bookchin about supplying in a, I think you said in an organic society, like, needs are supplied no matter what. So I just thought that was an interesting point. Alex, what were you going to say?
Yeah, I was going to say, well, I agree with you. You have a right to, in this day and age, electricity is one of the things that should be, you know, a human right. But I was going to say, I want to preface this with the fact that people saying that the voters who put this administration that allowed this deregulation to happen in charge deserve this in some way is ridiculous. But it's also, in the same way, reaping what you sow. If you're going to promote deregulation, which under capitalism is defined as freedom, you know, the freedom to, in this case, exploit people and force them into contracts that make these kind of outrageous bills legal and okay, things like this are going to happen. Crises like this really are going to expose that.
I think that's a big thing that came out of that is the former Texas governor ended up saying that Texans would spend even longer in freezing cold if it meant thwarting Democrats who want to address climate change with new regulations. I just think that's something of a ridiculous thing to say, that they would rather have people suffering than dealing with having regulations.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they really like to apply really narrow definitions to words that are really, really very broad in what they actually mean. Like a word like freedom means so many different things to so many different people. And really just saying more freedom, less freedom is, because of how broad the word is, it's basically meaningless. But when they, and they're kind of trying to evoke that vagueness because it just sounds vaguely good when you say freedom, when really what they're talking about is corporate deregulation, placing more power, not in really the people's hands, but in corporations' hands. And so it's kind of like a weird invocation of the word freedom, but that's conservative rhetoric pretty much all across the board.
Yeah. I had to a town hall for, in my hometown, I was like 17, 18, for my local Republican congressman, just to like see what it was about, you know, because why not listen to what people in my hometown have to say. But people were asking about regulating certain plants in our area.
When you say plants, do you mean like energy plants or like?
I mean tulips, like literal okay. plants. No, okay, cool. Energy plants. The town that supplies like the surrounding towns, like my like tiny rural town with jobs, is like a big Fortune 500 company that produces glass and ceramics. And these
is it now?
It's literally the town's name. It's that ingrained, but I digress. And people were making the argument that these companies are polluting the air with certain kinds of chemicals. And he's saying, and our congressman's response was that because the current regulations can't be measured to a certain degree, like because we can't measure it, and they're putting this cap on, I'm not sure, emissions of these chemicals, and that actually can't be found currently, that all regulation is bad. And he equated that to big government and everything. And everyone's like, oh, hell yeah, dude. Don't let big gov keep you down or whatever. And me and my friends are just looking around dumbfounded. Like these people are just eating it up. And it's really sad to see.
Yeah. Because I think a lot of the grievances with big government, at least some of my more conservative leaning friends, is that like government is big and funded, like all these politicians are funded by corporations. And I mean, like there is a lot of hypocrisy and there's a lot of not seeing the whole argument, but I do understand that like money in politics is a big issue, and that creates a lot of these problems, including like how people were blaming renewable energy for the Texas crisis.
Do you guys think there was some, like, what do you think the incentive was for Greg Abbott to bring up, like, this shows how the Green New Deal would be a deadly deal for the United States of America, and blaming that situation?
I mean, besides like just normal PR, it's just, he's just playing on political tribalism. You know, he's going to take any opportunity, even if it doesn't make sense, to exact conclusions from incomplete data, just take what he wants to see from this. He'll take something obvious like, can windmills freeze? Yes. Okay, therefore, people who aren't gonna do any further research are gonna assume, okay, that was the cause of all this. That's why people don't have power and people have electric bills.
That's the same reason why Donald Trump Jr. is talking about gender neutral potato head in his CPAC speech. it's definitely like, green energy is definitely a wedge issue that can just be used, that's like very efficiently used to rile people up and just get them to be mad at whatever it is you need them to get mad at. And then of course there's also the fact that like the lobbies of all the various other kinds of energy production that happen, especially in Texas, you have a lot of natural gas, a lot of oil, I think you have a lot of coal as well. Those are industries with really powerful lobbies. And so there's also a material incentive to kind of steer the negative attention away from natural gas, which is where most of the problems actually were, and towards green energy, which was a relatively small amount of the energy that was lost. And yeah, that would be another good example of a contradiction between the material interests, the actual material interests of a politician like Greg Abbott, which is to his donors, to his own pocketbook, and against what is supposed to be the social purpose of his position, which is to serve the people.
What about how I think the media goes into this, and how people like Fox News are like just completely lying and saying, claiming that the Texas power grid has been completely relying on windmills. And like, what do you think? What is there? Why are they like incentivized to say that?
I mean, I'd say it's probably about the same reason, right? I'm not sure if you, we did an episode way back on Noam Chomsky's manufacturing consent, and he talks about the five filters of the mainstream media. And of course, when you talk about the media, you can't talk about all the media at once because there's so much diversity in there, even just between the two halves of the mainstream, like your Fox News and your CNN defined halves of like the mainstream media. But when it comes to Fox, especially, like there is a force that is taking away from that social purpose of the media to inform people and towards the capitalist purpose of a media company to profit. So you need rich companies to advertise on your channel to make it popular. So some of those are oil, natural gas companies. So I'm going to give them good press. You the person who owns the company is very rich themselves. So that's generally like a lot of like anti-labor messaging. But when it comes to anti-green energy messaging, maybe they just have stock in these, it changes from person to person, but there's a general, you can generally rely on the interests of one extremely wealthy, business owner aligning with the interests of others. And in this case, that's generally against at least radical adoption of new green energy and heavy regulation of the energy market.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, like Mark said, it's whatever it's going to rile people up. There was, if you look at viewership among mainstream media outlets, your CNN, MSNBC, Fox News, all of them in a very correlated way dropped off soon after Joe Biden was elected, because all of their programming is centered around, what's hot, what's the conflict, what's happening, what's divisive, what are people tuning in to watch day in and day out. And for the last 4 years, Trump has had a monopoly on that, and now their cash cow was gone. So they have to find new ways to branch out. And they've always done this. So this is kind of them going back to their old ways, but just highlights their incentive to focus on crisis and negative, and emotions, negative or positive, usually negative. But in this time, Texas Energy took that spot.
Yeah, and also to milk the hell out of whatever the most recent conservative lol cow is, which has very quickly become Ted Cruz, because he's like the most absurd human being I've ever experienced being aware of.
I was thinking about launching him into space, but I don't think he's a billionaire.
I don't think he's a billionaire, yeah. I'm not sure if we actually have any billionaires in the Senate.
I feel like we'd know about it by now, right?
Kelly Loeffler was the wealthiest member of the Senate. And I think she was like a 100 millionaire, but I don't think she was a billionaire.
Okay.
Yeah, Mitch McConnell's like 60 million, I think, 60, 68, something like that.
You know, we talk so much about billionaires that you forget that someone with like $60 million net worth is still really, really rich.
Yeah. And I think also those politicians money is just a form of power. It's a way to achieve your goals, and having an elected office is just another form of power. So Ted Cruz is just as powerful as a billionaire, even though he doesn't have that in the wealth form.
I remember I watched an interview with Bill Gates a while back that was really, really telling in kind of like a subtle way, where he basically, someone asked like if he'd ever thought about running for a major office, and he said, honestly, like, just overseeing the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, I probably have more power to affect things. I was like, yeah, that's probably true, actually. And that's pretty wild, to be honest with you.
He suggested that he should run that?
No, he said that he had no plans for running for any kind of office because he probably would lose power being in an elected office than he just had in comparison to what he has just being really, really wealthy.
Mm-hmm. That's crazy. It's like, even if you believe that democracy it works, at least in this country.
This form of democracy.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's what's that word that you're using earlier? There's inconsistencies.
Contradictions.
There are contradictions.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I think I kind of want to transition to, because it's a lot of the same stuff that we've been talking about, but transitioning to talking about ExxonMobil.
Okay.
I think they're a very interesting case that connects climate change and capitalism. And I wanted to hear your guys' take on, or if you know about how, like in the 80s, ExxonMobil published this, or they employed a bunch of scientists. They published this report that basically said, yeah, our business model will create irreversible catastrophic climate change because fossil fuels do that. But then they took that information and said, okay, we're going to make this misinformation campaign, basically making climate denial, and that they got involved with media and all of this stuff to, instead of changing their business model, just create climate denial and climate skepticism. That is because they have responsibility to their shareholders. Would they have acted differently in a non-capitalist society, like a socialist or a communist society?
I think maybe in a socialist society, they might be tarred and feathered instead of made rich, but one can dream.
It obviously depends on what alternative to a capitalist system you're talking about, because, you know, it's really just a matter of, yeah, it depends obviously on like what the alternative is. So like, let's say that specifically we're talking about an alternative where you have like a central, you have like a resource extraction company or institution of some kind that is, instead of being privately owned or owned by shareholders, it's owned by the state. Their base, and the state is elected democratically. The position that is actually in charge of the institution that is extracting the resources is either elected democratically by the people or elected democratically by the people who actually work in the process of labor of resource extraction. Then I think that there's still some degree of contradiction there, because, you know, obviously not everyone's interests are the same, and it is the general tendency of institutions to kind of self-perpetuate and try to keep doing the same thing, because that's just easier than changing. But if you are placing the power into the hands of everyday people, who are the people who are actually going to have to deal with climate change, who are, you know, going to see their property maybe end up underwater, or going to have to deal with the worst effects of the changing climate, like as we saw in Texas, the worst hit people by this kind of crisis were low income neighborhoods, Black and brown neighborhoods, and these are so the whole point of like instituting a socialist economic system is to give those less privileged people more power in the economy. And so I think that the contradiction would be significantly lessened, because right now the situation we have is that the people who get to make the decisions for what Exxon does are the people who have the least to worry about when it comes to the direct effects of climate change. They can move if they need to, if something goes underwater. They can, you know, afford to buy generators if their power goes out for some reason. They can afford security if order temporarily breaks down for one reason or another. And so there's all these ways in which they can shelter themselves from those negative effects that in a democratic system, the vast majority of people who are being given power can't do. And so are, even if they take a pay cut because they work in resource extraction, that might be worth it to you, as opposed to if you can totally isolate yourself from the negative effects of climate change. And so that's broadly why I support socialization of something like resource extraction, energy production, and kind of similar natural, local, monopolized, very like low, or very low demand elasticity kinds of industries.
Thank you. That was very insightful. Alex, do you want to add on to that?
Yeah, and just so I'm aware, the original question was, what would happen if ExxonMobil or an institution like it buried a report like that in a separate society, right?
I mean, you can answer that question, but I was thinking more of like, how would ExxonMobil respond? Like, would they bury it in the first place?
So I'm most of the way reading this book right now, but I'm gonna try my best. But I'm reading a book right now on anarcho-syndicalism. And so let's say, I know Mark's so excited for me to finally finish this. So let's start with it. Anarchism, there's no central authority. So what's there in its place? Because it's syndicalism, the closest thing you have to a governing body is trade unions, right? So each collection, each sort of industry, let's say there's one for natural gas, petroleum, lumber, what have you, livestock, whatever. And none of these institutions are above or below one another. They're all on equal playing ground and they support each other equally. And it's theorized that, you know, in an anarchist society, you know, greed is a capitalist creation. So there's no real incentive to gain more material wealth because you have everything you need theoretically in an anarchist society. So there's no reason for you to like screw over your friends. So I guess specifically in most anarchist societies, they wouldn't bury this. They just wouldn't because it's theorized that there's no need to. And in a syndicalist society, I guess it would be brought to the attention of, I wish I could remember the name. There's a specific name for a council of trade unions.
Is it a syndicate?
And no, that I feel like that'd be too too easy of a jump. But it's like a three word name, and it was really cool. I'm kicking myself because I forgot it, but it'll be brought to the attention of everybody, and they'd say, okay, we realize now for the betterment of everyone involved in this society, we have to move away from fossil fuels. So what are all these workers going to do in place? And they'd probably slowly phase it out. They probably wouldn't stop. Like it wouldn't be feasible just to stop it. Stop drilling for oil immediately. So they'd, I guess, phase in green energy or whatever they thought was the best course of action.
Right. Because it is a tough issue, especially with like, there are kind of two different sides of like environmental issues. So I would see in that society, like obviously, you know, if there's a plant that's polluting and creating asthma, I feel like that kind of society would be very quick to replace that with something cleaner. But then there's also, I feel like climate change is its own thing in that it's caused by CO2, which isn't a pollutant. So you would have to know the science to know that it's a problem. So, and it does kind of take looking ahead. So people like, you know, the Koch brothers or the Koch brothers, Freudian slip, maybe, they know that they're going to be fine. So they're going to take shelter from it. But they still know about it. That was leading to a question. I forget what the question was. I got caught up about the fact that I just said top.
Don't we all?
Alex and Mark, how do you think that connects to that last paragraph, the section of the book that you read on your podcast on Bookshin about how environmentalism was right now is only an investment, really? Like the way we think about it is as an investment instead of just being a part of our world and something that we have to interact with, and it has like its own, it has the right to be like treated as something that we care about.
This is actually one of the things that I really wanted to dig into a little bit on this today, which is that there's kind of a couple of ways in which like left-wing political theory can change the way in which we think about our relationship to the environment. Because right now we have a completely toxic idea of like what our relationship to the environment is, where it's not just that we have a right to use anything for whatever reason that we want to, but it's also that we don't even have to think about what the consequences are going to be down the line as long as it's profitable today. So anyone should be able to understand that that's like completely messed up. But even if you take like kind of like the Karl Marx approach to it, where you're conscious of the contradictions in what you're doing and you're trying to avoid that. So you might be sustainable for the sake of human society being sustainable and being able to continue. But then when you talk about someone like Bookchin, it really goes a lot deeper than just being sustainable for the sake of continuing human civilization. And you move into that, you move into a much more kind of subjective, almost like emotionally motivated way of thinking about our relationship with the environment, where we start to think about the environment as having a right to exist for its own sake and, you know, not needing to justify why we shouldn't build in this place or why we should let this ecosystem be. That doesn't need to be expressed in dollars in the capitalist sense or even in the Marxist sense, like doesn't need to be expressed in terms of like a return on investment for human wealth, human well-being. And I ultimately think that, I think that that's a way of looking at it that understands how humans operate a little bit better than like the really heavily materialist, like mathematical Marxist way of looking at it. Like something that's like really, really cool that we see happening under MAS in Bolivia is the granting of human rights to the earth and to the environment, which it remains to be seen what the long-term effects of a declaration like that is going to be. But I am of the opinion that it's a really, really good idea, because you start moving away from, all right, well, we need to come up with a reason to justify why we shouldn't do this kind of development, why we shouldn't you know, extract this resource or destroy this habitat. And instead we're moving to a mindset where we assume all of these things have an innate right to exist. And unless we can really justify making use of some part of the environment for a real genuine increase in human well-being, which I think is a perfectly reasonable reason to extract resources, use the environment, whatever. But it puts the onus more on us to prove that it's a good idea than to kind of put it on the environmentalist to prove that it's a bad idea. I think that's a much healthier place to be.
Yeah, I feel like we're in the, at least in the US, I guess in most first world capitalist societies, it's kind of not the earth has an innate right to exist and I am part of the earth. It's I am on this earth to consume as much as I can, and it is my right as a human to make everything I can commodifiable. I can do whatever I want. And in the same way that Mark was talking about, people don't want to do things that don't give them instant gratification. At least in America, you see something, you want it, you get it. That's, I guess, like the current American dream. But that's why we don't, same reason we don't invest in things like education, because you're not going to see an immediate output unless not till like 11, 12 years down the line when those kids graduate from public schools. Unless you can see an immediate effect, we just don't want to do it.
That's a really, really good point you're making about how people don't really think of themselves as part of the environment, even though we undeniably are, and how harmful that is.
I think you guys are definitely right. Like, I just wanted to, like, a lot of people, NGOs who are trying to make a change or activists, one of the things that they say is like, the people who like want to save the tree is like, you already have them on board. Like everybody, but like the only people you have to convince are the ones who think in that way, where they're completely profit motivated. And it's just completely different mindsets on how we should be treating our earth and how we have to protect it.
Yeah, and like one of the central problems is that because money is power and money is accrued in large numbers by being as ruthless as, you know, willing to exploit as possible, that we end up in a society where the most like Machiavellian and ruthless amongst us also end up with the most power. And then we have situations like this.
And then they're the ones that end up getting to, as you say, like, as you say on your one podcast, to like control the narrative. And like,
yeah,
whenever someone brings up that other argument, they can just, they have the power to bring everything back to the money portion of it.
Mm-hmm. I kind of see it as like a, it's the powerful versus the powerless. And because those who are the most Machiavellian accrue power, they can accrue an insane amount of power. And then there's just a class of people who have so much power, and they're not going to really care about, they're not going to see themselves as part of the earth. The people who do, they're going to try to squash that narrative. So I feel like that's kind of why we do this. Expand this narrative. Like we call ourselves Save the Earth, but like the earth is so powerful in and of itself. Like we can't save it.
Do you guys think under our current political system, just regular regulations and the things that we have, like that we have the ability to like put onto companies, are enough to cause enough change to mitigate and stop the climate chaos?
Am I a doomer if I say no? Or like...
No, I think I would agree with you.
Okay. I didn't want to be on that side by myself.
I definitely agree. I think that there's like two ways of looking at it, which is like, on one hand, like it's theoretically, I do think it's like theoretically possible to regulate the current system to the degree that would be necessary. It would be draconian. It would be very restrictive regulations. It'd be a ton. But I think that theoretically you could do it. But the problem is that we don't have the distribution of political power that would actually make that happen. And that's really like the core of the problem, is that like our institutions are not interested in protecting people's lives enough to make those regulations possible. And that's why a transition to a system that is more representative of what the average person just going about their life actually needs from the whole of society is what makes taking the kinds of steps towards a more ecological policy actually politically possible in ways that they just aren't right now because of how the power is so messed up.
Yeah, like we talked about regulation at the beginning of this episode. A lot of people would have to get cool with a lot of things very quickly.
Right.
Yeah.
So would you say that revolution is necessary in this sense? I know you guys have an episode on reform versus revolution. With the climate crisis in mind, what would you say about this?
You know, revolutions are really, really scary, and they often don't really go the way they're supposed to. But at the same time, like as the climate catastrophe unfolds and as life gets significantly worse for hundreds of millions or even billions of people, like I think more cards are going to end up on the table. And if the choice is that we end up with a state that decides to fight climate change by, you know, culling a population or by restricting resource or like by hoarding resources in really unequal ways, then I think that revolutionary action would be justified and necessary. Yeah.
Yeah, I can't see, like, at least the way it's going now. When you say revolution, I'm assuming you mean like a coordinated effort from a large majority of the population to take control of the current state, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I feel like at least in our, you know, alienated, disconnected society today, you're much more likely to see like lone wolves committing acts of maybe like, and this is just my theory, acts by themselves against large energy corporations or something like that. I feel like people are definitely will be angry enough to do that the more this continues.
Right.
I think the problem would be that by the time you have the majority to agree on this topic, it's like once the actual, they can see the effects of everything going on, like at that point, it's just too late.
Absolutely.
Majority agree.
That's the thing that scares me the most, is that like, if we had a really long time frame, I would actually be kind of optimistic. But just like that, when you look ahead and you realize how short the time frame we're actually working with, it's not just that like, oh, we're gonna have to try something really, really extreme to get done what we need to get done to save society as it kind of exists right now. It's like, oh, I don't know that we can do what needs to be done. Even if we're willing to do anything, I don't know that we even could.
Yeah, it's kind of depressing. Yes. That even
really
when,
depressing.
Well, I was just gonna say, even when Al Gore was popular, he wasn't. He was pessimistic, and that was decades ago.
That was like 20 years ago now, or something like that. When did Inconvenient Truth come out? Don't worry about it. Doesn't matter.
Was that both like before or after he lost to Bush? So I want to say it was like 2000.
I think it was after.
Yeah, something like that. Just about 20 years ago.
But not too long.
Right.
And also, even like when there is recognition by the countries that hold power, like in the Paris Climate Agreement, and they all decided that we need to keep the temperature rise under 2 degrees, hopefully more towards 1.5 degrees Celsius. And that's not on track at all. We're currently headed to like at least 3 degrees Celsius of temperature rise per year.
Yeah, if I had to make a prediction about what's going to happen, I would say that as we approach that, like people say we have like 12 years to prevent or 10 years, it differs slightly, but you know, somewhere between like 8 and 15 years to like actually prevent a runaway catastrophic climate change that we can't reverse with even by hitting net or below net zero emissions. I think that as we reach that point, we're going to see more and more recognition of the reality, because it's going to start affecting the people in power in really, really significant ways when we start dealing with large numbers of climate refugees and stuff like that. And so I think we're going to see more recognition as we get there. We're going to see more extreme action. I think we're going to see states taking very extreme action as we really, really get close to that catastrophic place. But I don't think it's going to be the kind of action that most people are going to be very happy with. I think it's going to be very draconian. I think it's going to dump a lot of adverse problems on the parts of our society that are already suffering the most. And, you know, I can't really get more specific than that, because it can what the actual effects of climate change are going to be vary so much from place to place, and what the already existing political dynamics also are just as diverse. So, but that's broadly the pattern that I expect to see play out, is that we're going to see, you guys familiar with the term eco-fascism, I imagine?
From your pod, yeah.
Yeah. I imagine we're going to see the majority, honestly, of what we consider to be like liberal democratic societies, not necessarily like adopting a fascist government, but engaging in a lot of fascistic behavior surrounding climate catastrophe as a way of addressing it without really trying to get rid of the contradictions in the capitalist system.
And that's kind of like the hoarding the resources you said earlier.
Stuff like that.
And I feel like kind of the solution to that is just having strong community ties, honestly. Maybe that's just my bias, but I feel like either way, if there's a kind of eco-fascism, or if there's just kind of a disorganization with everything because of a climate catastrophe, I feel like the way that we protect ourselves is having connections with people and just supporting each other. People like, you know, just regular working class kind of people.
I think that's a good place to wrap up. You guys want to remind everyone, or do you guys have any last words?
No, I think this was a great conversation.
Yeah, no, I thoroughly enjoyed myself. Mark, do you want to do our wrap?
I can do the wrap up. So our podcast is We Read Theory Pod. It's been a little while since we've put out a new episode because life has gotten a little bit crazy on my end. But we are very much still doing the podcast, still making episodes and stuff. So you can find our catalog of about 30 or so episodes as is on pretty much anywhere you find podcasts, Spotify, Apple Music, whatever random app you might have on your phone. Not Stitcher. People have asked us if we're on Stitcher. We're not on Stitcher. You can follow Alex's shitposting on Twitter at We Read Theory Pod on Twitter. You can
also post in our subreddit.
Yeah, you can.
r/ We Read Theory Pod.
You can post on our subreddit, which is kind of fun, I suppose. I think that's it. Yeah.
Well, thank you.
You don't have a secret OnlyFans, right, Mark, that I know about?
We'll be looking forward for your next episode, guys. Thank you.
Thanks, guys. All right, appreciate
thanks,
it.
Thanks, guys.